May I date this first, please? This is the Tanaw Yukon Historical Society meeting in the Chamber Log Cabin in Fairbanks, Alaska. On May the 28th, the meeting was to start at 8 o'clock. Interview. And we have for us guest speaker, Mr. Humphreys, which will give his name, where he's born, and when he come to the country and tell his little story.
Do I take over from now?
Yeah.
Well, I was born 81 years ago yesterday.
It makes a noise. I might fix it up.
I was born 81 years ago yesterday in the little town of Nottingley in Yorkshire, England. I grew up to be old enough to walk and talk and earn my living, and came to America in 1906 in January. I worked in New York City for 3 or 4 years at various things, and construction work mostly. And I came to Alaska at a minute's whim. A friend of mine had been in Alaska, and he, on his way back from England, back to Alaska, he says, "Why don't you come along?" So I said I would. I just bundled up and came. I've been here most of the time since. I'd been doing indoor work, and I wanted to get outside. So it developed by the time that we got to the Pacific Coast that my friend was broke. So very soon we were both broke. And in line with my intention to do outdoor work, I went around and rustled a job. I got a job in the interurban freight sheds in Seattle, wheeling a truck. First hard work I'd ever done in my life. But previous to that, it had all been clerical work. And luckily, I got a very good foreman, Bill Studemeyer. Very good man. He taught me how to run that truck and how to stack the stuff. And he laughed when I told him I'd never worked before, but 2 or 3 days I was flipping that truck around and stacking stuff up properly, but I was kind of weak. Five sacks of spuds on end and fall down, I had one heck of a time to put them up again. But I finally managed it. After being there 2 or 3 days, he found out that I could write and read. So he put me doing a lot of billing and stuff, and he offered me the assistant foreman's job if I'd give up the idea of going to Alaska. No, I was headed for Alaska, the north. So a man that had been sick came back, and I was out of a job again. But in those days, it was kind of easy to rustle a job if you just went around. I found a job with Stone and Webster, building steel in a concrete building in Pine and Pike. And worked at that until I had enough money to buy a ticket to Alaska. It was $45 then to Cordova. I wasn't coming gold seeking, and I had no idea of being a gold miner. It was construction work I wanted to be in. And the construction work at that time was the Alaska Railroad and Kennecott Mines. I was headed for there. I forgot to mention that one of the reasons I picked Cordova was because our master mechanic from the Pennsylvania tunnels, the job which I'd worked on in New York City, was sinking those caissons for that bridge. And I knew him, and I knew his assistant. But due time, we arrived in Cordova after quite a stormy passage. Very interesting passage to me.
Do you remember the date about?
It was right after Christmas. I left New York City. By the time we got to Alaska, it was late February or early March. I think it was late February, because I was in Cordova some time. I remember I was in the Cordova on March the 17th.
What year?
Of 1910.
Yeah.
Because I had somewhere in my possession a four-leaf clover somebody had given me, and the bartender was Irish, and we showed him this four-leaf clover and thought he was a shamrock, but he wouldn't have it, he knew too much. Cordova was quite a town, man. It was full of men. You hardly saw a woman at all. You might see a woman doing a shopping in the early morning, but in the afternoon you'd never see anyone. It was all construction men, just milling around from one saloon to another. And you know the type of frontier town we had in Alaska. It was all there. The first night we got there, it was raining like the dickens and blowing. Snow and rain. The old taxis packed our stuff up from the dock. It's about a mile from the dock to the town. Got there, wasn't a bed to be had. So we sat all night, myself and this George Taylor, we sat all night in the barroom chairs in Jimmy Cascaden's saloon on C Street. And that was a different kind of saloon that I'd been accustomed to too. There'd be a few back in the back benches where I was sitting. It was full of men sitting around like me, all dead broke. But somebody would come in and a big shot, and they'd say, "Everybody have a drink." So everybody would climb up to the bar and drink, and then as soon as the drink was over, they'd go back to the bar room chairs, except the people that still had money. And it was the next day before I was able to find a place to sleep. Mrs. Snyder, she had a new clapboard building there. It still smelled of turpentine and sawdust. It was very, very clean and comfortable. And then there was a problem of finding work. So the next day we filed over to the railroad yards. See the Catala Company's agent, employment agent. Nothing doing. We didn't get anything doing for about 3 weeks. But I don't know how we ate. We didn't have very much money. I think I had $5 when I landed. But we ate anyhow. I don't know, perhaps we borrowed money or run a bill. It was easy to run a bill, too. I think Billy Lindig was running a place he called Billy Lindig's Kitchen at that time. Now, I got to know quite a few people around the town at the time. There was Adam, had a drugstore there. There was Sam Broom. He was a big merchant and a banker. There was Finkelstein and Sapiro. They were men's outfitters. Joe Diggs had a little grocery store and a post office. A fellow called Wolf had a paint shop. Cap Lathrop at that time was running about 6 horses as an express company. He drove one team himself sometimes. But he was doing a land office business because there was lots of hauling to be done, and I think he had the only horses there. He also had an ice business, and I think he had a water business. He had some water lines running somewhere, because I remember seeing him putting stable manure around the pipes to keep them from freezing. After about a week or 10 days or something, I got shipped out to Camp 49, where the bridge was. And we just piled us off there and told us to go to Camp 49. must have been 20, 30 of us, so we piled over there and we had to walk through the snow about a mile, packing your bundle. All new to me. It was quite a change.
Can you hear over there? there?
Not very well.
You can run
ahead. Yes. This was my picture the time I arrived in. At the time I arrived in Alaska.
For the tape, Mr. Humphreys is showing us a picture in an early day paper.
I was the secretary of the Queensborough Bridge Celebration Committee in New York City at that time. You'll notice I'm in pretty good company. But, well, not so many months after this, I was a laborer of no fixed abode. But enjoying it immensely.
Well, you liked the construction business then. You were in that for
I was in construction business. I became a timekeeper on a dam in Yorkshire when I was 15 and a half years of age. I took a man's place. And from that time on, I was a construction man. I was timekeeper on various contracts in England, the Birmingham, the Bradford Waterworks, then the Birmingham Waterworks. I took a year off when I was 19 to do a little studying and get some education, because my formal education stopped when I was 13. What I've acquired since on the wayside by reading.
That's a wonderful. That's a wonderful souvenir. It's the Queensborough Bridge Celebration in 1909.
Yeah.
June 12th, 19.
Where?
In New York.
New York.
Mm-hmm. The completion of the Queensborough Bridge.
See, we're just up to mile 49.
You're at
mile 49.
Mile 49. Tired and hungry. Well, Camp 49 looked kind of tough. But I discovered later it was the best camp I was to be in on that railroad. So we went in and had something to eat. Before and after we'd eaten, they rolled us out to as many as they could get, new, bring a shovel. And we had to shovel snow into a locomotive to make water for it. And that was some job. It was blowing a gale that time. I know you could shovel that snow up and it would blow away. We shoveled and shoveled and shoveled. I think we got to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. Then the bell rang at, I said, it was like 5 or 6 o'clock, rolled us out and went. We had to go to work then, putting freight across the lake in front of Miles Glacier. And it came on flat cars from Cordova. That was railhead at that time, it was mile 49. The freight came from Cordova. The bridge wasn't complete. We took the freight from the flat cars and put it on gold devils or sleds. And it was taken down to the lakeside, loaded on a scow, they called it a gold devil. It was hauled by two donkeys back and forth. And there was another crew at the other end unloading it. A wild man called Scotty Fox, running up and down alongside of it, bawling first one engineer out and then the other because they couldn't keep steam up on the fuel they had. But mountains of supplies went up from there. Hay and beef and case goods, all kinds of stuff. Lumber, big bridge timbers, everything. I learned to use a peavey there. That's the first time I'd ever had one in my hand. That was something I liked to use too, was the peavey rolling those big logs. It was quite a trick. And ties, you had mountains of ties.
What type of fuel did they use in the locomotives in those days?
Oh, coal.
Coal?
Yes. Coal, it was brought up from the States too. It was the Nyma coal, I think. I worked there until it got to be quite nice weather in 2 or 3 months later. Then I decided I wanted to go up ahead. So we went through the formality of drawing a pay. There was no There was no routine at all about getting your money in those days. You just quit. A man would fire you. All there was to it, he'd hire you. There's no paperwork or any rigmarole of that sort there is now. You just took your money and went. Well, I went. I took mine with somebody else, and we went up ahead to a place called Teakill. There was a camp there. It was run by the Heaney Company, and they soon discovered it wasn't nearly as good as the camp had left. The food was poor quality. Part of it, but sometimes it was sour. The mush would be sour in the morning. And it was really, really tough. The bull cook, or whatever they functionally call him, bull cook, he showed me to the sleeping quarters, a tent with 640 men in it. That's quite a tent. The whole place was full of. It was spring, you know. It wasn't dark, really dark at night. You could see the light coming through the tent. And you see all this tent full of the top row, the before wide, at the top row, too wide on the outside. And about half these bunks, you'd see men sitting up, smoking and talking. Some of them were delousing their shirts. 90% of them were lousy. I stayed there a little while and. Three or four weeks and learned to lay track and hit a spike on the head and tamp a tie. And then one night I heard they needed a deckhand on the steamboat. The steamboat landing was mile 103. So I went and saw the mate, and it seemed to me I was always able to get the job very easily. I don't know why, but I saw the mate and asked if he needed a man. Yes, he did. Come tonight, build his stuff. So I went back to camp and I boiled up all my clothes and did everything I could to get clean again. You just made a campfire outside in a clearing, took out coal on a can and boiled your clothes. That was the only facilities you had. So I went as a deckhand on the steamboat. Well, I liked that very much. That was something new to me too. We spent quite a time putting enough wood. We used wood for fuel on the steamboat. By the way, there were three of those steamboats, and they'd been packed overland from Valdez over the Tasnuna Pass, up the Low River, and over the Tasnuna Pass, and down into Chitno they had put together on the river. Three quite large steamers. I think the one I worked on was called the Nizina.
How far did they run up that river? Well,
you see, there was a very bad rapids at Miles Glacier then. There wasn't navigation from the mouth. Mm. In that canyon there was very bad water. But after they got the railroad from Miles to Tiki, there was a Woods Canyon, and they had to get the stuff up ahead to the mines. So they used steamboats, took it to Chitno, and then there were teams and whatnot take it up from Chitno Landing up to the Kennicott Mines.
These steamboats ran from where to where?
From mile 103 to Chitno.
That's around Teakill, is it?
Teakill.
Teakill is
it's the mouth of the Teakill River.
Yeah, mouth of the Teakill River. We call it Teakill. It was called locally Teakettle.
The distance of how far?
Well, the steamboat landing was 103, and Chitno is called mile 130, I think. So it was something like 30 miles. And during this time, the station gangs were trying to get a road bed in Woods Canyon. They were blasting it out. They used carloads of powder blasting out a place there. But I enjoyed being a steamboat man. We stood 2-hour watches. And I was ordered to go out on front and take the sounding stick and sound the water. It was all very nautical and very fascinating to me. You'd take the stick, and the officer would say sound, you'd put down 6 feet or no bottom, and it was really good. Well, a few trips like that and I was ready to go again. So I got off at Chitnaw. I'd had a couple of friends that said they were going into the interior. And they were just ahead of me somewhere, but I don't exactly know where they were. So I took my bundle off at Chitnaw and decided I'd go to the interior on foot from there. Chitnaw at that time was just a little clearing, not very much, in the forest. And you could see people here and there that chopped a few trees down and were trying to build cabins. There was only one cabin completed. That was being built by Billy Tibbs and Tom Holland. And I got to this cabin around 7 o'clock the morning after I got off the steamboat. I had my breakfast on the steamboat. And I asked them how to get to the Fairbanks Trail. Well, you go right up this canyon here, follow the trail, and keep to the right hand of the third lake and so on. Well, I took my bundle and a little grub with me, and I mushed up this trail all day till about, several hours later. I tried to get past on the right side of that lake. I couldn't find a trail anywhere. I couldn't find a trail on the left side. Well, I thought, and some sort of a dumbbell anyhow, so I went back to, it was so late then that I made a camp. I just put my bed out and made a little campfire and went to sleep for the first time in my life. I'd never slept in the open. Well, I was quite well repaid for that sleep, because I hadn't been lying down there very long when a mountain goat came right down from the side of the hill, right down to the water. I'd never seen anything like that before. It was a wonderful sight to me. And when I got up in the morning, I went back to Chitnaw. I thought these fellows would laugh at me. Well, they didn't laugh very much, but I said, well, I'm still going to the interior, so I'll tell you, go across the river. There's a fellow running a ferry, they'll carry across the copper and the cotsina for a dollar. So I wondered, how did this fellow up? And got another little packet of groceries to carry me for a day or so. I packed my bundle with me and I went up it's the left bank of the river, I guess. It was the right hand looking up, they call it the left bank, I think, of a river. And I walked along this place, quite a good trail, and it wound in and out among the timber. And by and by, I came to a little camp, the littlest old woman in the world you saw there, a little Indian woman. She came out and jabbed to me. She couldn't talk about English. She was Horse Creek Mary. She had a lot of dogs there. She held them back from sniffing too close to me. And she was living there all alone. And I forgot to mention, while I was walking along the riverbank, I could see Indians down below in a boat. And they stood up and waved their arms at me. And I could see Doc Billam in this boat. Doc Billam was a famous Copper River Indian, and he always wore a tall silk hat that somebody had given to him. And he wore that hat for years and years. It was hardly held together. That was his mark, Doc Billam. He was a medicine man. Goodlatte was the big chief, and Doc Billam was the little chief, I think. Well, about a mile beyond Horse Creek Mary's, I came into quite a large camp. Well, there was nobody in the camp except dogs and one man. One man I saw. There were probably some women, because the women usually keep out of the sight when the strangers are out. I talked to this man, and he could understand a little bit of English. And we sat down and offered him a cut of my Westover tobacco. That was it. We smoked in those days. He asked me if I'd like something to eat. Yes, yeah, so I went into his cabin. And his wife had cooked salmon, which was quite palatable, and tea, and I offered him a dollar. No, I wouldn't take a dollar, but I could see he really liked it. But he says, "You've got little monies." He'd seen I had some dimes and quarters and whatnot. He asked for the little money, so I gave him the little monies I had. And then he wanted some tobacco, so I gave him half of my tobacco plug. And we parted very good friends, and I went on for another hour or two, and by I got down to the river, and I could see an American flag flying on the flat. So I went down to this place where the American flag was flying, and so I noticed that there was, by authority of the United States Army, this such and such a man had been appointed, given permission to have a charter for a ferry, and a uniform charge of $1 per passenger. And he was nowhere in sight, but I could see across the river there was a new roadhouse being built. That was the place I was looking for. So I hollered, and by he came across and pulled his boat across the flats and the shallow places and whatnot, and I got him and he took me over there. And Tom Senior Jake Nashtead had just completed a roadhouse. Very clean and comfortable and nice. And I had money to pay for my entertainment. And I don't believe there's anything quite so nice in the world as an Alaskan roadhouse after being packing a heavy bundle all day on the trail and sweating. So I sat up quite late that night, smoking pipe in the pipe after supper, and listening to the water on the riffles. I think at this point I caught up with the two men that were going to go with me. George Taylor, that was the man that I came from New York with, and an English laboring man called George Flowers. I often wonder what became of George Flowers, because I parted with him that summer and never saw him again. Well, and Jake set us on the trail to get to the Fairbanks Trail, which was simply a path mostly paralleling the river. The Tonsina came down from his upper roadhouse to his lower one. And the next, that was quite a long walk too, but we got there, I think, the next night, which was going backwards. And from there we turned north toward Copper Center. When we got to Copper Center, the roadhouse keeper asked us, "What are we going to do?" "Well, we think we're just going to head into the interior, see what happens." "Well," he said, I've got word from Jack Ingham, the superintendent of the road commission. "He wants some men. You'll stay here for a few days and you'll be along and you'll do work with them." And that was just what we wanted, so we stayed around and enjoyed life at Copper Center until they came along. Rigwell Blix was the roadhouse keeper there, very fine man. I knew him some years after that. And Charlie Cowell, he had a saloon there. Charlie was really a big man there, but I think he fell on evil days or something, because the next time I saw him, he was a teamster in the Middle Fork of Chistochina in 1922. And sometime after that, I read his name on a gravestone, either in Kennicott or Carthy Graveyard. So we stayed around Copper Center, and I went to work with the road commission, and so did my partners. The foreman's name was Fred Walters, German blacksmith. Pretty good man, too. And he found out that by very shortly that I knew as much about a shovel as I know about a violin. It wasn't very much. And he told me, he says, did you ever work at this stuff? No, I hadn't. He says, you'll have to do a little better than you've been doing. Well, I didn't have very much money, so I did a little better. I did a little better, and I learned to use the shovel that year. That facility that never lost since. It's the number one instrument in Alaska pioneering days, the number two shovel. And, there was a Swede in the outfit. He was, I think, he was 53 years of age. I thought he was a very old man, 53. But I watched him, and he could shovel three times as much as I could. But I went to work alongside of him, and I watched his motion, and I learned the best I could how to use that shovel. I can still use it today. And I learned to use an axe and how to keep it sharp. I chopped a new pair of $11 logging shoes before I got the hang of that, too. And we learned to chop trees. At that time, the Fairbanks Trail was simply a slash through the timber. You could see the trees almost meeting at the top. And our job in Walter's gang was to widen this trail out. And we had to dig ditches on the side and make a trail, a wagon road, two shovel handles wide. That was 20 feet. And in the marshy places, we just went to the side and cut down small trees, put them in the mud, and then we dug ditches alongside and put the mud on top of the poles, and that was your corduroy road. And we put in culverts every so often, ditches and culverts. That was the Alaska, the old time Fairbanks Trail, built that way.
It was being used at that time too? It was being used?
Oh, it was a winter trail.
Just a winter trail.
The summer traffic was nothing. once in a while you'd see a man come through on horseback, but there's no vehicular traffic. You couldn't... when our teamster went to town for a few things, he'd ask if you wanted anything. Well, I remember one time I asked him to bring me some Bull Durham, and he started telling me how much overloaded he was. He couldn't pack an extra bag of Bull Durham. The roads were so poor.
No wheel vehicles.
Well, that was wheel vehicles. We see the road commission, they brought their own cabs with them. They gave us mosquito tents, two men to a tent, the big mess tent. It was good cooking. We bought our own food at army prices. That is, at the end of the month, the foreman checked up the grocery bill and he said, your board this month has cost you 52 cents a day. Well, that's what you paid for your board. And sometimes it cost you 60 cents, but that was just army prices. And we had good cooks. There was no reason we shouldn't, because there wouldn't be a poor cook out from town. But if you didn't cut the mustard, you simply got your money and you had to walk. You were on your own then. There was no responsibility for you except yourself. Well, I worked all that summer. Fred Walters and I was young, got muscular pains and whatnot from working, but I was getting stronger every day, and I got quite I was feeling better all the time too. I got so I could throw those 100-pound sacks of spuds around pretty lively, worried me a bit. I went back to town, to Valdez on foot, but just loaded the stuff on wagons and pulled into Valdez. We made camp every night, made about 20 miles every day. We didn't stay at the roadhouses. The snow chased us in about the middle of September, I think. We got back into Valdez. And in those days, many outdoor men didn't figure on working in the winter time. They just took the summer stake and bought a little grub and either rented a cabin or put up a tent or something and lived in themselves. That was the fascinating part about Alaska in those days. You didn't need to ask anybody where you could camp, because you could just go and camp almost anywhere, and the wood was free and the water was free.
What year was this?
1910. Yeah.
Didn't realize how well off they were.
They didn't realize how well off they were. We liked it. We shipped up to McCoy's camp at mile 146. We were to complete the Cuscolina Bridge there. Well, McCoy's camp was no great shakes. It was very poor sanitary conditions there. And I got tonsillitis very badly. You had no place to wash except in the creek, and there was another place where the grub bottles would go down. But I got tonsillitis, and they sent me down to a hospital on the bar at the Chittenau Crossing. It was a tent hospital. It was about the size of that room with the partition across it, and the beds all around. Doctors, there was a doctor and a nurse. It was a male nurse, I think, male nurse, a male orderly. The doctor was quite kind and looked me over. He said there was no room inside, so I'll go over to a tent and live in this tent. And they gave me medicine and I went into this tent. There was no fire at all. I had to rustle wood to get a fire going in the Sibley stove. It was blowing a gale as it often does in the Copper River there, and cold. Well, I managed to get some kind of a fire and get into a bunk close to this tent. I was using my own blankets. There was no provided. But I stayed there about 3 days, and then I was sick enough to get well again and go back to camp. It was much easier to be in camp than it was to be in the hospital. I went back there and worked a little while longer. And while I was there, I was in the bunkhouse one day, and I heard this educated English voice talking to somebody below, and I sat up in my bunk and looked over. Here was a man I became very well acquainted with later, John York, ex-Northwest Mounted Policeman, younger son of an aristocratic English family. In fact, in the little valley that I come from, his uncle was the big landowner and whatnot.
Peter?
Yeah, this boy was the son of Sir John York. Mm-hmm. Well, I spoke to him. He, for some reason or other, he could tell I was English too. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. And finished up by us going to Cordoba together, and we were partners for quite a few years after that. We got to Cordoba, and from there we bought a little outfit from Blum and went up to Algonac, mile 21 on the railroad. At that time there was a little excitement in Lake McKinley, a very beautiful little lake 5 or 6 miles from the railroad, looking for quartz claims. And there's quite a few claims had been staked too. And there were two crews driving tunnels. One working for Doc Chase, and the other for a company that Doc Chase was in, and another company with Judge Tucker from. He was the United States Commissioner, and I think they felt they were going to get rich. And there was another up the mountainside. There was a man called George Handy, and he had an American boy with him. George Handy was a German, by the way, ex-German officer. He later guided Dora Keene on an ascent of Mount Blackburn, and after that he married her. But we none of us made ascent in that business. We trapped a few skins and sold them to make tobacco money, and that was about all. And in the spring, I was very fortunate, and I think I was fortunate to this day, because I've never seen anything like it. It was the return of the waterfowl to the Copper River Flats. Right, I was right in the middle of it. Mr. White will be very familiar with that kind of thing, but that's the first time I'd ever seen it. And I've never seen anything like it since. There was thousands and thousands of geese and ducks, all kinds of aquatic birds coming in there day and night. It was a bedlam, but a most delightful experience to me. We had been living on the only fresh meat we had was porcupine and a few grouse we managed to shoot now and then. And roast goose went pretty good. After the sun began to shine, I decided I'd go back into the Chitno country again. So I went back up there and was rehired by the Road Commission in the same manner that I worked for the year before. It apparently changed his mind about me because he was very glad to get me again. So I'd apparently learned a little bit. I worked with them and we got along fine. The next year I worked with Lars Holland. By this time I'd learned how to use an axe a little bit. I was rated as an axeman and built culverts and bridges. The second year it was a Chitno cutoff trailer working. That was when I learned to use the axe. I had a Norwegian partner, and we had to put in these timber culverts across this 20-foot road. You put in two mud sills, five stringers, and a decking, and then two guardrails. You bound all these together without a nail of any kind. It was all done by you bored holes in the guardrails, put pins in there. That was what held the whole structure together. Well, this Norwegian and I was a felon. He was a fine man. We nicknamed him the lieutenant. We made a motion study of this thing, and he'd do a certain thing. I'd do the digging because I'd dig better than he could by that time. I'd dig the holes, and he'd get the mud sills ready, and we'd drop the mud sills into place and put the stringers in place and the decking on, trim it down with the adze, and I bore with a 2-inch auger, put down holes for the pins, and we had the pins in. We could put one of those in two of them in a day, and it was quite a good time. We'd put one in about 3 hours and then sit around and look at the boss, because you could put them in faster than anybody else could. The next year I went to work with Lars Holland, he was building. He was one of the original men that was with Captain Abercrombie. I've got Captain Abercrombie, the account of Captain Abercrombie's excursion into the Copper River country. And Lars was one of his men, an old Norwegian. And he was a bridge builder, trail builder. I went out with him in April, with his gang, early in April. We put in piers in the middle of the Kolkana River. And built them crib piers, filled them with rocks, and left them there for a gang later to come and put the bridge across. I don't remember what it was, a timber bridge. It was probably a pre-fabricated bridge there. Then we went on to Miller's Creek, and in our outfit we had a donkey engine and a pile hammer. We sent this donkey engine down on the bar and the pile hammer out of the back end of the wagon. Then we had to go in the woods and pick out two straight pieces of timber for pile driver gins. Everything was done. We made that pile driver, the skids, and the decking, and the gins, and we even trimmed out the slides up the gins, I forget that what they call
guides.
Those. Guides, yeah. Put the pile in there, and in a few days we were driving piles, and they were bouncing back off the frost. Every once in a while you get a pile down, but for the most part we had to dig a hole and put a little powder dynamite in there, blast a little bit. We finally got a bridge across Miller's Creek. I've never been along that trail since, been across Miller's Creek since that time, but I know that was quite a long bridge, and there was quite a torrent of water came down there in summertime when the ice was melting. We put another bridge up a little further along, and we put the first bridge across Jarvis Creek. I remember quite well, what a beautiful spot it was on that flat at that time. It was wooded with the nice straight spruce timber. A beautiful spot. The family's loused up now with all kinds of...
So that's Jarvis Creek on this side of the mountain?
Yes. Yeah.
They burned that off. They must have burned that off since then.
It was a beautiful straight timber in there. And we didn't have to go very far to get all the timber we needed for that bridge.
Paxson's Roadhouse there then?
Paxson's Roadhouse was there then. It was a very, very nice roadhouse. A fellow called, I don't know who was running it then, but Nichols ran it later. Nichols, and at the time I went over the trail then, Nichols was running Yost's.
Yost Roadhouse?
Yes. He was another ex-Northwest Mounted policeman. And
were you still partners with your policeman?
I'd left him because he didn't savvy that kind of work at all. He didn't like it. I forget what happened to him then, but we joined up later on. But I don't know what he was doing that winter. But this time I was my sidekick was I was Cephalon, the lieutenant, as long as we were bridge building together. He and I worked together very nicely. After that year, we walked out to Valdez, and I quit somewhere in the. I quit there before the season was ended. I quit there walked out with a United States soldier, and you know. He was one of the nicest fellows you could possibly imagine on the trail. Helpful and a good companion. And when he got to town, he got his money. He got quite insulted because I wouldn't roll around the saloons with him. So I thought I was high-toning him. The first thing he did was to get his paycheck cashed and go on a toot. Well, that wasn't for me. I took my money and... Somewhere in the picture, I joined up again with York. I don't know whether he was in Valdez at the time or not, but we went to... I think we went from Valdez to Juneau. That was in the fall of 1912. The reason we're going to Juneau, because it was just percolating to the westward. The communication wasn't very good in those days. It was just percolating to the westward that there was lots of work in Juneau, and it was booming. When I'd come through it in 1910 and got off the bottom and on through Juneau, it looked like a dead town. You could just see lights burning in the saloons. It was raining like the dickens and the windows were dim. We walked uptown from the boat and were glad to get back again where it was cheerful. But in 1912 it was booming. Colonel Jacklin, the big Utah copper man had financed the development there that something similar to the Treadwell. Huge quantities of ore to go through a mill, and if it was a dollar of a ton in it, you could make money. Well, York and I went over there, and he got a job doing some kind of surveying with them. I went to the office and it was a very busy place, and I got in to see the manager, Bart Thane, and he asked what I'd been doing. Well, I thought when I went over there that I might learn something about hard rock mining. But no sooner discovered that I knew how to write and figure that I'd have got a job for you, so he sent me up to Perseverance Mine as mine accountant. And I went to work with George Jackson as the superintendent, and everything was just booming, busy, and there was lots of pep in everything, and the whole town was jazzed up. I thought they had the world by the tail, I guess. But I went up there, and it was a very nice place to work. I hadn't been there for a week before they told me I could put myself on the payroll at a bigger salary than they promised me. And I think I got three raises in about 3 months. I thought this was a fine place to work. Jackson, the superintendent, was another Englishman, a Yorkshireman in fact, from my home county. But he'd become a mining engineer. He'd gone out to New Zealand to be a sheep farmer. And from there he found out that he could get an education in New Zealand, and he studied to be went to work in the mines and studied to be a mining engineer, got his degree, and worked in South Africa as a mining engineer, and come up to Alaska. And he became superintendent. He later became general manager. He was a very fine man to work for, and a very good engineer. Well, I was a mine accountant for about 13 months, and one day I heard Jackson and his assistant going over the freighting costs. I didn't like it. It was costing too much by the load, so I thought it'd be best if we contracted this hauling. So they were going to sell the teams and contract it. So I made the proposition to the general manager, Bart Thane, that I'd I think I'd saved about $1,000 or $1,200. They were a huge sum in those days. And I made the proposition that I would buy the teams on time and do the hauling for them. I'd learned something about handling freight and horses weren't strange to me because I'd been brought up with horses from my boyhood in England. I'd had riding horses and driving horses. It wasn't too strange for me. And they, a few days they talked it over and they said they would. So I bought this outfit on time, contracted the hauling. I was quite fortunate. I had 6 4-horse teams. That for a short time I had the biggest freighting outfit in the territory. It was only a band called Woods in Seward. Had some teams, and another man called Billy Rowe in Nome, who was moving dredge parts. These skinners, the long line skinners, they moved around from one outfit to another, you know, and they tell you about them. I had some of the finest men I ever met driving team for me.
Billy Rowe drove for you?
No, Billy Rowe had an outfit in Nome. I say, I got some of the men that had worked for Billy Rowe. These fellows would tell you where they'd come from, and I got so I could, the man asked me for a job, I could tell right away by looking at him. He was a skinner, he wasn't a skinner. I didn't even need to ask him. But I did all their freighting for quite a number of years and did quite well at it. And then...
Now you freighted from where to where in this?
From Juneau up the coast of Perseverance Mine.
Perseverance Mine.
That's up Gold Creek.
5 miles up Gold
Creek. 5 miles up Gold Creek.
These teams, we'd load up at the Juneau dock and we'd make 2 trips a day.
Well, those packs are in wagons, freight wagons.
Wagons.
Freight wagons.
Wagons and sleds. Sleds in the winter.
Go devil,
sleds. No, sleds in the winter. Common sense sleds. And for part of the time we had to go on wheels to halfway and then transfer the stuff to sleds for the balance of the distances. In the winter time, I also, for a short time, I ran a stage, and I nearly had some bad luck there. I had my sleds widened out to the common sense sled is a narrow tread. But I had my bunks widened so that you had the same tread as a wagon. That was for my own convenience, so that when I was using wagons or sleds, they'd use the same tracks, you see. Well, at that time, the first automobiles were coming to the territory. The man had started a stage, to the mine. And it was a little exasperating. If he hadn't had my sled trails to work in, he couldn't have run his automobile. Well, I had a sled stage, which just like these sleds they used to have on the trail here with cross seats, and I could carry about 25 men of these common sense sleds. But going up there after Christmas holiday, I had a 6-horse team there. I wasn't driving it. My name McNuck was driving it. 6-horse team and the sled packed with men, 25 or 30 men on it. And this automobile right round the bend there, I forget what we call that bend now. It was right where the road drops off into Gold Creek. This automobile was stuck in the snow. You know, 6 horses isn't a short distance. You could run from here to the fireplace there. And this man, when these horses got around the turn, he couldn't see this automobile because the horses doing their stuff, they went around it. And this man was just backing out of this snowdrift. He backed those leaders over the precipice. Oh, Al McNutt But not so what had happened. And he was out of the sled in a jiffy and cut those leaders. One dropped out of its, one dumped down and cut out of its collar, and the other, he was pulling the other along with it, and he cut the harness. The wheel team, the swing team, fortunately stayed put.